Appreciate the introduction. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
All right. Well, when we talk about premarital counseling or care and marital counseling or care, many of you who have theological gifts are thinking to yourself, well, I won't be spending much time with that. But let me assure you that in my first weeks as pastor, I realized how much time will be taken up in this area. You need some skills in the area, people skills and counseling skills. And if you do well with premarital work, it will save you a lot of trouble post. Plus, you'll also have developed relationships with these people so that they've not only heard you, but they've seen you, they've seen your marriage. What you model, how you listen to them, how you treat your spouse, communicates a lot more sometimes than what you think. And so we're going to, obviously, if you've looked at your handouts, you said no one can do that many slides that fast. And you're right, I'm not going to try to do that. I'm going to highlight some things and give you my approach. But I thought if I put these in your hands and you can access these, I'm happy for you to have them. If there's a way you can adapt them and use them in your churches. I do a lot of marital conferences, weekend things, night things. First Baptist Dallas and Southeast Christian has a premarital series of classes. And one of them on physical intimacy, they would always import me to do it so that they'd have a doctor talking about sex. I don't know why that is. Apparently, deacons don't like to talk about the topic. But that is a good way to do things. But as you learn from the very fine questions at the end of Dr. Drake's section, somebody needs to talk face-to-face with the couple, as well as the group setting. I can think you can do a lot of it as a group. But somewhere along the line, face-to-face, you have to talk with them and find out what's really going on in their spiritual life. How are they in terms of communication skills? What can you do to help? And that key question is, when in your spirit you feel like they're not ready to marry, how do you say this isn't yet the time? Those are great questions. That's practicality. We've got to be able to take the theology of marriage, which is key, and bring it into practical application. How does that look? You not only have to live it, but you have to help others to live it. Some churches are employing marital mentors now, couples that have been through a lot of time and hooking them up with young couples. I think that can be really helpful. Not to delegate everything, but depending on where you are called to serve, hopefully the Lord will raise up some gifted people that can assist you, because very quickly this can multiply and your time could easily be taken up doing nothing but premarital and certainly marital work afterwards. All right, well, as I said, there's a lot that I would like to talk about. This is the model that I use, and I use the same one premaritally as I do after marriage, because I think understanding marriage theologically and how intimacy works is the key to honoring God and glorifying Him in marriage. So I use this pyramid picture because it reminds me of the levels of intimacy: spiritual intimacy, relational intimacy, and physical intimacy. From the moment they say, I do, to the moment the Lord takes one home, they are one. God has declared them so. So the first thing I delve into, and those of you who have survived the marriage enrichment class know this is how I teach it, is to understand what's going on in their prayer life, what's going on in their life with the Lord. Even if they come in because there's sex problems or he won't take out the trash, I often will start with, well, how's your prayer life and how are things going at church? Because if that's wrong, everything else is wrong. This is foundational. This is where the Christian worldview makes a huge difference. Secular counselors can't touch that. They can teach him how to communicate better and how to resolve conflict, which is useful, but it will never do what we can do, because marriage is an intensely spiritual institution. We need to see it that way, and those of you in leadership need to make that a goal, because your church members have to understand how important marriage is. God has used that as a light, as a lamp of Christ in the church is supposed to be evidenced in husband and wife relationship. And as we communicate that, not only do we have to live it, but we have to encourage people along the way. Relational intimacy, communication skills. What we have learned now in years here in teaching the marriage enrichment class is that many of you gifted communicators are not really gifted in one-on-one with your spouse. While you can preach it, you can't listen well. We're not taught to listen well. And this is a skill that when we have the young couples and we do some exercises with them, you realize there's some things that one can learn in terms of not only communicating clearly, but listening well and not having preconceived things. So we spend some time on that. And of course, with my background in OB-GYN and as a certified Christian sex therapist, I'm not hesitant to broach the subject, because a lot of issues will surface there. Ideally, I think premarital counseling would include a good Christian physician and a good pastoral counselor, whether he's this, you know, senior pastor or a counseling pastor or an associate. I don't think that matters, but it's someone who is theologically skilled and also someone who can help answer some of the physical medical questions, because they're both involved. All right. Well, that is the background. I often start out by asking them what they think marriage is. And you would be amazed at some of the answers you get. Even in marriage enrichment class here, it's something that's worth discussing. It's not like I give such great advice that marriages are guaranteed to work out. What I try to do is draw out of them and find out how are they relating, how deeply do they understand each other and their giftedness and how God has designed them, the background, the ethnicity, all the different things that people bring to the marital relationship, to sort of start working at exploring that. So it's not so much what the questions are, but developing a rapport. And a lot of soul care and premarital marital care is you radiating the love of Christ in such a way that they trust you and will share with you what's going on. And then when issues arise, you will be the first person they think of as maybe you can offer some help. So what are some of the things couples need to know? And we're pretty strong in this area because we have the biblical understanding of what marriage is supposed to look like. Do not hesitate to share that. They're expecting it. So when you have premarital couples or marital folks in conflict, do not shy away from opening the Word of God and one-to-one showing them what marriage is really like. Because most of the problems you will face are because the eyes have turned inward to self. I'm not getting my needs met. He's not doing this. She's not doing that. And it's all about me. And that's not biblical marriage at all. And so we understand the whole idea of living for the other, of a sacrificial kind of love, of submission to one to elevate them in godliness. It's all about the other. And so we have the great opportunity to explain what a covenant relationship is, because that's a vow before God, and God takes that very seriously. And as Dr. Drake mentioned in the earlier lecture, there are a number of people that can perform marriages. Any justice of the peace is competent and legally entitled to do that. What we are doing is asking God to bless this relationship. And that means, in my view also, that they need to believe in the God I'm asking to bless their relationship. Because a covenant vow before a God you don't believe in, I'm not sure what that means exactly. So, we talk about these kind of things. It is commitment, but it's commitment and covenant. It is a legal contract. Those who've tried to break out of it, and when marriage is fractured, there are significant consequences. But the key piece is to understand what covenant is about. I use a number of things to try to generate conversation and sort of see where they are. Because when they first come in for premarital counseling and you ask them, why do you want to get married? They all say in unison, because we're in love. And love is one of those four syllables up and down, just riveting, eyes glossed over, everything's great. And you realize that most of what you say is not going to sink in. But you try to plant some seeds that later you can draw from and try to get below that and realize that marriage, to work well, requires sacrifice. It requires work. It requires commitment to love well. And many don't see it that way. They see it as just, oh, this is going to be great. We just love one another so much. He finishes my sentences. He has so many cute little habits. And within 6 weeks, those cute little habits are really obnoxious. And having those sentences finishes are really annoying. And then they want to know, what have I gotten myself into? Well, we can sort of preload that by exploring some of the fact that none of us is just perfect except for Christ. These are the key areas of problems, and it's sort of some safe zones to talk about, at least time and money are. And many young couples haven't thought about that. So this is an opportunity. I use usually 4 to 6 sessions to successfully complete, and I won't marry a couple that hasn't been through counseling. It doesn't have to be with me. It can be at a place where I understand how they're doing it and we're on the same page. But couples need to understand time issues, and that's really true here on the seminary campus, because time escapes. If you've got any reasonable number of hours and you're working and you have a spouse and kids, you have already exceeded the number of hours in the day. So in order to love well, it's really a challenge. And I must say I got interested in dealing with marriage back in the days of medicine when I cared for many seminary couples. My office was right next to Dallas Seminary back then. And the seminary wives were the most miserable women in my practice. And I asked them why. It's because their husbands were spending it all at work and there was nothing left for them. And that's not how it's supposed to be. Money issues, many think that two can live as cheaply as one? Anyone tried that? If you fast the whole time, I suppose it could work. And then, of course, the sexual issue is more of a barometer of what's going on. It's usually not the key piece. It's usually a reflection of some areas in the relational or the spiritual. Not always. There are some pure physical problems that our doctor visit before marriage, when you send them to the family doc or the OB/GYN to understand things. A lot of that can be solved beforehand. And I always like to solve things before they become a big problem. So when we talk about intimacy, intimacy is a big picture for me. It's that two becoming one picture, the bad math but good theology from Genesis. When I do the conferences, I have an old illustration that I've used since 1980. It's the Play-Doh marriage. I still love it. And basically, I have blue Play-Doh that represents the boy and yellow Play-Doh, because pink doesn't work, to represent the girl. And intimacy then becomes when the two become one. And it starts out as a, you know, a blue lump and a yellow lump. But once time and you work them over, it becomes a green lump. And the picture is that over time, husbands and wives start to change and they become more one. Now, if you divorce, if you separate that lump of green, you don't get the blue and yellow back. There are changes that occur over marriage. They are not unforgivable, but they need to recognize that. And in the times that we live, where many of the people that you will be ministering to will have already been through a marriage or two, and carry the wounds and the scars from that. And understanding how best to deal with that biblically, it's important to really think through. I see while marriage has some rules, it's really about relationship. It's a work of art. It's a work in progress. Jane and I have been married 32 years, and I'm a much better man and a much better husband now than the beginning. I love her much more deeply because I understand it better. I was clueless back in those days. So understand, if you're talking to a 15 and 16-year-old like Dr. Drake was talking about, clueless does not begin to describe where they are. But it may be the best thing to hook them up with a couple that's more mature and walk them through and hold their hands until they mature enough and honor God in that way. I like to see myself as a work in progress, no problem with that. This is a definition that's not mine, but I really like it, about intimacy, to be fully known, fully loved, without fear of rejection. And that is, in fact, how God loves us. Understand that apart from the Spirit of God within us, we can't love that way, but it is a worthy goal to shoot for. Most of us are not fully known because we figure if they really knew us, they wouldn't love us. But as marriage deepens, there becomes a trust and a level of oneness that I think God has designed to really evidence His love for us. All right. I put these in your handouts because these are the sort of the secret killers. The ones, if you don't ask about, you'll regret it because it's going to come back and haunt you later. Unconfessed sexual sin. I do ask them, have they kept themselves sexually pure? Is there any areas in their past that need to be discussed? Because I think before you marry, you ought to be able to decide whether that works for you or not. To not find out that your spouse was pregnant and aborted or had a child out of wedlock and learn after you married and then have to deal with that and not know whether, well, if I'd have known, how would I have done that? And then, of course, there are those who come for counseling who are already living together. This is a problem for me. So I ask them to live apart for a season as we go through counseling and then perhaps consider continuing the process and marrying them ultimately. Unacknowledged sexual ignorance. As one who teaches sexuality and Christian counseling on this campus, ignorance is rampant. Okay? The misunderstanding in our society where we talk about sexuality, or at least it's blared in front of us, it is amazing how a proper biblical approach to the wonderful gift that God gave to be expressed fully within marriage is so distorted that it's really hard for people to find the joy that God designed. And so that may require for you some getting used to talking about some things that you're not, but you will be seen as an authority in these areas. And while you don't have to diagnose and treat things, you ought to be able to know where the problems are and when you need help in those areas that you feel competent to help with. I put the undeserved sexual exploitation up there because Archibald Hart did a survey of 2,000 Christian women. It's probably 4 years ago now. And half of them, 50% of them, had experienced unwanted sexual touch growing up. You must understand that will have impact on sexual intimacy in marriage. And so it's a fair question to ask. Is there anything in the past that's happened? This isn't to excuse it. It's to understand it so we can help people realize where some of those barriers may be. And there's a lot of that out there. And we live in a time of enormous time pressure, all manner of stress, that really funnels and focuses into the relationship. And what looks like it's going to be great fun, once a couple is together and realize there's bills to be paid, there's a lot to go on, it can be overload. And we can be not only preemptive by explaining this is pretty normal. You can expect some of these feelings of desperation. But then how to walk through it, who they can call, and how they can get some help. Bottom line for me is godly husband, godly wife. And to do that, you have to build it on a biblical foundation. So unashamedly, we teach them what the Word says about it. And I start in Genesis. And the whole idea of maleness and femaleness needs to be understood, because it is desperately misunderstood, and sometimes it's badly taught. I've had people that have believed that a woman's not made in the image of God. She only becomes an imager of God when she marries. I think that's nonsense. I think the Scripture, it's important for us to understand what the Word says, and for you each individually to work that out and understand some of the terms. What does helper suitable mean? What's that azer word really look like? It's a good word. It's a glorious word. It's used of God in the Old Testament. It's not a servant picture, but it's a compliment picture. It's one who's gifted and brings to the marriage something that's missing. Man was alone, and it was not good. God made the woman, and it was very good. So we're talking about a relationship that's beautiful, that should excite us and excite them, and not just in the physical expression, but in the fact that this is something that will picture beautifully how God loves. And so I walked through the Old Testament pictures and help them to understand it, and understand that this whole idea of leaving and cleaving, of setting up a new family, is biblical. You respect, you honor your mother and father, but once you say, I do, this is a priority relationship, and that spouse across from you is a priority person. Many marital problems crash right there. Trust me, you'll hear about it because, well, he always says about his mother, and it's just lovely conflict that you can maybe avoid some of by explaining. Some of you may have lived through some of this. It's pretty common stuff. And the physical intimacy and the naked and no shame is a picture that we need to speak of, because there's still a lot of shame involved, even within marriage, because of stuff people have brought to the table or the way they've been taught. If you've heard for 18 or 20 years before you got married that sex is bad, sex is dirty, sex is awful, don't do that, then you say, I do, and all of a sudden it's supposed to be beautiful and wonderful, you are misguided. It won't work that way. You can't change your brain around that way. Sexual expression is a beautiful thing in its proper context. And that's the way we should share it, and share it clearly so that they understand. The fall obviously comes in and it affects everything. And that's really helpful as you speak to them, to let them know they too are sinners, as am I. And when you put two sinners together in one relationship under one roof, you're going to have some conflict. Apart from the Spirit of God, it's going to be chaos. But with the Spirit of God, it can be glorious. And I help them to understand, or try to, that the curse, the results of the fall, have effects all the way down to us, both in terms of the labor issue, as in his labor, and the labor issue, as in her labor, and the whole conception process. All of that is fallen. All of that has been affected by the fall and the curse. And so there may be some problems that unfold later in terms of fertility and miscarriage issues that I think are related to the fall as well. So I'm not bashful at all about starting out and laying in thickly the spiritual intimacy piece. They're expecting it. I love it. I think it is foundational and fundamental. So I'm not bashful about discussing a theology of marriage, that they can start to develop one. I spend a lot of time in Ephesians, and I'm going to briefly show you some of the things that I try to get across, because in my general circle, which is generally Baptist, there are some, it's not so much a misconception as a, I think, maybe an imbalance or an overemphasis that when clarified, can lead to a nice unity, which I think is what marriage is about. This comes right out of Scripture. Created as a partner is the helper suitable. Commended as a woman of valor, Proverbs 31. Commanded to submit, Ephesians 5:22, which follows 5:21, which says, submit yourselves to one another. Very important to understand that whole husband-wife thing in Ephesians is an illustration of the teaching that preceded it. It doesn't stand off by itself. It is then followed by the teaching of parent and child and master and servant. And so we need to keep it where it belongs. And we'll talk a little, I'd like to clarify those issues, because the husband has responsibility, the imperative to love as Christ loved, to nourish, to cherish. Lovely words, No words of authority anywhere in there. It's all words of other-centeredness, unconditional love, living in such a way that she would be spotless and blameless and pure and those sorts of things. And that's kind of a different attitude than some of us take from that. So I camp a little bit there. And the mystery of marriage from Ephesians 5 is that the Christ and the church relationship is mirrored in the husband and wife relationship. See, that's some heady stuff to think about how I love my wife, that people that look at our marriage should be drawn to Christ, that the love within our homes should be of such a nature that it stands out, that it is dramatically different. It's the kind of love that people would be drawn to, not put off from. And I think we set the bar high because God has called marriage such a precious thing. And if you get to counsel people premaritally or after they're married, this is what it's supposed to look like. This is what the standard is. How are we doing? Are we approaching it or are we just ignoring it? A spiritual leader is sort of the buzzword of the day. And unfortunately, we get hooked on the leader part and not on the spiritual part. I try to thoroughly encourage the men to be godly, because leadership in our day and age gets the impression of, I'm the boss and I tell you what to do. And you will find nothing that looks like that kind of leadership or that style of leadership in Ephesians 5. It's just not there. In fact, the word that's key in Ephesians 5 is lover, the agape. So if we're spiritual lovers, I can work with that. But the spiritual is the key piece, and that whole picture is trying to show us unity. I put this in your handouts to walk your way through Ephesians because we're getting to the application illustration when we get to the husband and wife relationship. Be not drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. What does it look like to be filled with the Spirit in the marriage relationship? If you're filled with the Spirit, what it looks like is he loves unconditionally, she submits as unto the Lord. Both acts of worship, both in submission to the Holy Spirit. That's how it's supposed to look. Very different from the I'm the boss and I'll tell you what to do approach, or I'm not going to submit to him because he's a jerk. You like that part, huh? Okay. There actually is not a qualification there. When people marry, they are covenanting before God, he to love as Christ loved, she submit as unto the Lord. And when they hear that, sometimes they sort of shudder. And if they're not willing, if that doesn't appeal to them, that's fine. They're not ready to marry. Because if you marry and that's not your approach, it will not be a biblical marriage. So when we look at these walk in unity, walk in love, walk in light, walk in wisdom from the book of Ephesians, then we get to the illustration of the husband-wife relationship. And the picture is Christ is the head, the church is the body. The picture is unity, oneness. And in marriage, the husband is the head, the wife is the body. The picture is oneness, unity. Now, if that's the case, if you believe me that the picture is about unity and the husband is the head and the wife is the body, then what is divorce? Yeah, and I use that word and I put it in your handout because I want the dramatic effect of what divorce is. Our society doesn't see it as decapitation. It sees it as, well, this isn't working, let's try something else. God has declared something one that no man should put asunder. It's a big deal. And before I would encourage people to marry, I try to explain that well. Once they are married, I try to help them understand that so that they can learn to live as one. Now, we also use headship. And I think head is a good word, but in our mind, we think of head of the corporation or you know, the big dog, the one that makes all the decisions. But headship in Ephesians is head-body. It's a picture of oneness. The head without the body can't do anything. The body without the head can't do anything. They are one, and together they can do what God would call them to do. It's really a lovely picture, and the spiritual thing I put up because that's where I think we missed the emphasis. Headship, but I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man. A man is the head of a woman. God is the head of Christ. So it's important as we understand headship to not try to do in the husband-wife relationship something we don't want to do in the father-son relationship, because there is a nice parallelism there. So I would suggest that leadership is about initiating. Biblical manhood to me is the initiation of grace. You are the first to step out to follow the Lord. It's not that you're in charge. You're not. You are following Christ. Christ is your head. And that's a picture that I try to communicate, to take out the idea that the head of the house means I sit on the couch with my remote and I tell people what to do. I control the world, which unfortunately is the reality in some homes, as opposed to loving sacrificially, of living in such a way as to lay down my life for my spouse. So I put in your handout that leadership's about holiness, about a man on his knees in humility, obedience, sacrifice before the Lord. Very different from the world's view of what it is to be a husband. So the wife submits to the head because they're one. The husband loves the body because they're one. It's just an echo of the Old Testament, and the two become one. All right. As you can tell, I have a lot of passion and enthusiasm to lay in that spiritual piece, because without it, the rest of this is just techniques. All right? They have to get that. And if they're not shocked and awed by the fact that their marital success is dependent upon the Spirit of God, they don't get it yet. It'll never be what God wants it to be unless they are willing to yield their rights to God. Now, can they have a good home and stay together and be relatively happy? Many have. But that's not what we're striving for. We want to communicate to them what their marriage could be, what our marriage should be as leaders, or at least working toward. So once we put that piece in, then we talk about the relational intimacy. Now, if you are spiritually one from the day you say, I do, to the day the Lord calls one home, you are relationally one at all those times throughout life where you communicate, whether it's face-to-face, by phone, car, emails, those kind of things, where you're connected. And whereas spiritual intimacy is every moment, these are lesser moments. That's why the pyramid, because you're not together always. You're not talking together always. And unfortunately, a lot of couples spend a lot of time together without really relating at all. Many a marriage after 5 or 10 years or 15 or 20, when they come to talk to me, they're two people living under the same roof, but they're really not married. They don't know what's going on. They don't care anymore. They've become so callous towards one another. And some have learned communication skills that are deadly. Even some of our students here on campus have some ways of approaching and talking to their beloved in ways that just make me cringe. Part of it's training. What I watched in my home, my parents modeled virtually every bad behavior that's ever been studied. All right? Yelling, screaming, throwing, slamming, shutting down, not talking, I mean, everything. But if it's your home, you start to think, well, that's what's the norm. So what we needed to do is step up and say, no, I'm sorry that was your past. This is what the Word of God says. This is how two become one. And that happens with a lot of relational intimacy and communication. And so there are some useful books out there. None are perfect because the Christian community hasn't done what we need to do yet in terms of studying what we are doing. We say it works and showing evidence that it does. So what you'll read out there, Gottman stuff out of Seattle, Stanley Markman out of Denver, some lovely 20-year marital studies, but they're secular. They don't even ask the spiritual questions. So they can tell you what happens to relationships that don't have a spiritual foundation. And Gottman will tell you 67% of marriages will fail before they reach the 40-year married mark. I mean, it's just awful. And you've all heard the 50-50 statistics. This is an area we can make a huge impact. But I don't think we start there unless you've got a believer and an unbeliever sitting in front of you. Then you're going to start working both. You're going to try to work the spiritual in while you work on relational, to try to get the communication better while you're getting the gospel to them. All right? So relational intimacy can be a lot of fun. And I gave you in your handout some of the mnemonic things that I use to remind me to kind of keep the flow going, and some of the tools. I've designed a communication game, basically, to show couples how to not only talk, how to listen, to make sure that all that they want to say is out on the table, all that wants to be said is out there. Because what usually happens is someone floods out with all the data, and their opinion, and the other one never gets to say much except respond. And what we found, and this is in God-called folks here on campus. I mean, people that are, you know, spiritually sound and biblically solid, and they still are a little scary how they communicate. So it's been a good learning lesson for Jane and I as well, because after 30 years, you kind of get into a routine, and you almost talk without talking. And then you never really figure out what your spouse is thinking, which is a tragic loss. So I used the heart imagery because that, you know, and on Valentine's Day, what better time to use heart imagery? But the H is holiness, then the E's of conversation, and I'll show you those, the A's of listening, the resolution of the issue, and the two becoming one. Remember, the picture for me is always intimacy, that the two become one. And we try to change the dynamic of arguing from I win, you lose, or, well, we'll compromise, so we both win a little and we both lose a little, to we're one together. Let's look at all the data, let's hear each other's heart, and let's together pick what's best, a collaborative approach. Most couples think that marriage is 50-50 give and take. That is nonsense, because as soon as you set it up as 50-50, I guarantee you're going to think you're doing more than your share. That's human. That's our self-indulgent humanity. Neither is it 100-100 in my estimation. I think biblical marriage is 100-0. You give it all expecting nothing back. Now, if you get 100 back, which I hope that you do, then it's a beautiful thing. But if you're not willing to love your spouse, a couple in my church, the wife had Alzheimer's. For 10 years, she could not recognize her husband or family. He was there twice a day loving her. That's the kind of love that we're trying to picture. And people that aren't willing to do that are probably not mature enough for marriage, which most of us probably aren't. So what I do, and I use various questions and tools. I'll show you some books at the end that I use to catalyze conversation. If you want to use a personality inventory, as long as you don't pretend that it's biblical in any sense or that it has spiritual foundation, but you're just using it to sort of tease out some things to talk about, I think that's all right. But don't be labeling people that you're this personality type or you're that. I think that can be a bit dangerous. So the ease has to do with getting the data out there. I did a little, my wife and I did one last night just for fun. This isn't for everything. This isn't to decide whether you want hot dogs or hamburgers for dinner. This is when there's a big decision that needs to be made. So what we did was we went online and we looked up, in the autos, we looked up Ferrari. All right. Now the data on a Ferrari is, there is a 2005, it's called Scaglietti or something or other, I don't even know. But 540 horsepower, $265,000, you can drive that away. That's data, okay? Okay, now my wife's data would be, well, at $10 an hour wages, you'd have to work 24 hours a day for 3 straight years, taking out no money at all for anything else to pay for that car. Okay, that would be data. But I would look so good driving a Ferrari. You see how that works? And then how do you feel about that? I feel like you've lost your mind. Well, those are the kind of, and you know, healthy expressions of desire. I want one. Well, that's good. And then you come to the options. Buy one, not buy one, an embracing solution. Not going to buy one, but you can look at it online. You know, those kind of things. And you wind up, when you go through this, that there's not a lot of anxiety and pressure that you work it through. Each needs to share what they think, what they feel, what they want to do. And the other needs to hear all that without preparing their answers in advance. And I've had guys tell me, why should I listen to all of it? I already know what to tell her. Oh. Or they've already got the answer cooking and they've missed the last 5 minutes of the discussion. Doc, if I ask her how she feels, she'll tell me. That's when you know you got a problem. Because a man comes home from work and the wife says, honey, how was your day? And he says, fine. And we think that's conversation. But in fact, in a woman's point of view, it's not, or even close. And so if you ask her, how was your day, what do you get? Well, I went here, I saw there, we ate this, and this was on the menu, and she was wearing this cute hat, and you go on and on and on. Well, I learned early in marriage that you can either sit there blazed over and not get any of it and say, please get to the point, or you can learn that that's really how she communicates love and enjoy the ride. And as you watch the people discuss, and it can be the other way. I've had some very verbal guys where he can blow out 50,000 words a day and she much less. Average word count, normal healthy woman, 25,000 meaningful words a day. Normal healthy male, 10 to 12,000. So there's a huge disparity there. And if she's all day with little kids, there's none of those words are used up. All 25,000 are waiting for you, okay? And if you explain this to the young couples, they'll do exactly what you did. They'll laugh. But it gets through. And see, laughter's healthy. I think laughter's a wonderful thing. But also understanding is a good thing. And appreciating some of the male-female differences, because I think they're by divine design. I don't think it's a better or worse. I think it's because God knew we needed some of that. In order to get the best, you need some different approaches. And when you fail to listen to your spouse, of which either gender, I think you make decisions with less than all the information available, with less than all the giftedness that God has put into your home. All right? We had a couple in marriage enrichment class where she was a CPA, he was a chef. But they believed the Bible taught that she did the cooking and he did the books. They were miserable because the man loved to cook and she didn't. He was skilled at it and should have been doing it. She could do the books blindfolded and it looked like he did them blindfolded. So, you know, what we try to do is free couples. What has God gifted you to do? In your marriage, when you come together, you've got this whole skill set. Use it to his glory. Whoever's best at something, great. Well, who takes out the trash? Well, I don't think that's a high IQ item. I think you can work out whoever does that. And if somebody makes a mistake, which often happens, by the way, figure out how you're going to work it through. So this can be a lot of fun. This is, in shorthand, the game. And I'm writing on my sabbatic the workbook to go with marriage enrichment. And if you want a Christian approach to communication, it'll be available to you here at the bookstore. But the idea is, what does she think? What does she feel? What does she want to do? Same thing for him. First, you get all the data out there. And I have this in pieces so that you don't have the puzzle put together until you've heard about what he thinks, she thinks, he feels, she feels. And it's quite mechanical at the beginning, but what our couples learned is their conversation usually narrows down. He usually likes to talk about what he thinks, what he wants to do. She usually talks about what she feels and maybe what she wants to do. And you don't have the full picture until you've got it all there. Once you've kind of gotten in the habit, then this will probably be a relic that nobody uses, but it's a nice exercise to get people to think about how well they communicate. Yes, sir?
Could you explain the game? How do you actually, maybe even after better comprehension?
All right.
I didn't know how exactly do you...
This picture, this is a puzzle.
Okay.
Each of those is a separate piece, and she gets his pieces and he gets her pieces, and until he communicates his thinking, she doesn't give him his piece. So ultimately, for all the pieces to be back in the puzzle, they will have to have shared all of those parts and have said, is there anything more about that you want to share? Again, it's mechanical, but what couples realize is that they shorthand most things. Again, this isn't for, you know, which takeout you're going to have for dinner, but the kind of things, when I was leaving medical practice to go into the pastorate, if you're contemplating expanding your family, if you're contemplating leaving Texas and moving to Louisville like we did, those are big issues that you want to talk thoroughly through so that you can pray well through. And believe it or not, for Christian homes, prayer gets neglected. It's hard to fight with somebody and get really nasty if you've prayed with them and for them before you breach the subject. And so I thoroughly, even if it's a short prayer, thank you, God, for my wife. Let us work through this issue in a way that glorifies you. It doesn't have to be a high priestly prayer, you know, pray your way around the world, but just to remind you that you're children of God. And this conversation should honor him. What I tell some couples, marriage couples that are really fighting, is whenever they talk, just imagine me sitting between them. Because they're always nice when I'm in the room. It's apparently when they get home that they get pretty abrasive. So a prayer, obviously, it's so obvious, and yet we forget it. I like to make a point of this because it's one of those design features that's most enjoyable. The difference between men and women in terms of their thinking. I am the prototype compartmental thinker. When my mind is on this subject, it is on nothing else. If I'm watching TV or reading the paper, I'm not ignoring my wife. I do not hear her. I am focused in, zoned in, and it's just flying over me. Now think about this. I was a surgeon, a gynecologic surgeon. Don't you want me to have that kind of focus? If I'm operating on you, don't you really want me in the moment not thinking about what's for dinner or what's going on somewhere else or who the Cowboys are playing? You want focus. But it also can be detrimental, like in my days in the emergency room, if somebody'd come in with a cut, I'd just sew the cut. I wouldn't ask about all the other things going on. Women tend to be global, interwoven. Everything connects. They see the world together, and it's really a wonderful perspective to bring to my compartmentalness. But if you have a disagreement, the man is usually focused on this problem, this point, that he is winning, generally. Whereas the woman may see all manner of behavior in your past and get rather historical. Not hysterical, but historical, and bring up all those things into the argument. Understanding that can be helpful. In part of my practice dealt with infertility. And the way women dealt with infertility is very different from men. It's often a crisis early in their marriage to deal with it. For him, when they were talking about it, they were talking about it. But when they weren't talking about it, which any more than 20 minutes a day was too much for him, he's not thinking about it at all. Whereas for her, she's always kind. It's not never far from the surface. She sees a baby on TV, hears a baby cry at the mall, boom, it's there. This is not abnormal. This is normal. But if you don't understand it, she thinks he is calloused and hard-hearted and never thinking about it, and she thinks, or he thinks, that she's obsessing about it all the time. Just very different ways to approach issues. And if you kind of tuck that image in the back of your mind, as you hear the problems come towards you, you'll see this is starting to make sense. This is just how they're wired. It is sometimes opposite. Again, all gender generalizations are just that. So it's not to say this is how it must be, but if you realize in most marriages there is a difference, it can be helpful. If you understand how your spouse thinks and operates, and that's key in the counseling time, is to draw that out and help them see it. It's one thing for you to see it, you're skilled at this, but for them to see it, oh, I get it now. That's she's not obsessing, that's just the way she's wired. These are in your handout. They're obvious, but they're just reminders. These are the kind of things, just simple communication skills that I guarantee you folks fail at miserably. It's not just what you say, it's how you say it. The same words with different inflections or volume mean totally different things. When you're going to have these detailed conversations, who's going to be there, how long are they going to take? Many couples try to have these deep, intense conversations at bedtime. We had a rule early in marriage, because at about 10 or 10:30 at night, I get struck stupid. Stuff that comes out of my mouth, I'm going to regret. And any argument that starts, I want to win. Doesn't matter. I just want to win. Well, any of you who've been married long know that winning an argument is not generally winning. Okay? There's more that comes down the road. So in our household, if there was a big issue that dragged into the night, we committed that we loved each other and we were going to settle it the next day, but the wisdom would be for us to shut it down and not carry these on at 1, 2 in the morning. I've heard couples argue all night long, and I ask, is that working for you? You actually getting anywhere? And the answer is no. You just get more and more carnal. So back it out and pick the time and the place when you're rested, but don't neglect it. Once you've committed to talk through something, don't duck and dodge, which is another major sin. There should be time for relaxed conversation, should be privacy, particularly on these big kind of issues that we've been talking about. And don't forget the spiritual connection, the prayer part. The nonverbal clues, this is in all the sort of communication 101 things, but we tend to forget it, that just a lot of what you communicate isn't the words coming out of your mouth, it's the look in your eyes, the expression on your face, even your body posture. In fact, Gottman's work is mostly about body posture, how they're interacting, and these evidences of connection or disconnection, where he says within 5 minutes of watching a couple, he can predict with over 90% accuracy which marriages are going to fail. Nothing to do with content, just by the way they communicate, whether they touch, whether they're close, whether they face each other. Interesting study. Again, that's totally secular, but it should at least encourage us to look at that area as well. This goes along with the exercise. People need to know what the issue is they're talking about, because it's quite easy to bring in extraneous things and you never really can focus, and then both leave feeling very disturbed because they haven't gotten anywhere. All right, the way to speak clearly, calmly, concisely. Some come from backgrounds where any good discussion has to be at high decibel, high pitch. Not really. You can really carry on some very deep discussions where the division is deep in a very conversational tone if you're committed to honor God and love one another. And to try to teach couples, well, we fight like cats and dogs, but making up is so much fun. Not for long, it isn't. You know, there'll come a time where that gets really old, and nobody likes to be yelled at for long or demeaned or disrespected. And that's never necessary. You may have both valid points and disagree, but you can still respect and love that person that you have covenanted before God to honor. The listening piece, this is hard stuff because it's hard work. You think, what could be easier than listening? Well, if you don't listen, you'll drift because your brain doesn't like a vacuum, and you'll drift off to something you enjoy thinking about, and before long you'll swing back and you won't have a clue what's been going on. You'll be just going, yes dear, uh-huh, yes dear, uh-huh. Those conversations while reading the paper, and moments later you don't have a clue what you've just agreed to or disagreed to. So you really have to lock on, and that means acknowledging either with, you know, body language, a smile, a nod, a yes, clarifications. These are basic skills, but let me suggest to you who've come here today as one who counsels, most of the people you counsel will not have these skills. if you watch them for a few minutes, you realize men interrupt women virtually before they ever complete a sentence. It's a remarkable thing to watch. They won't interrupt men as frequently, but that's because we know where it's going and we've got something we want to say. And that's very disrespectful. And the woman who is speaking very quickly realizes, well, he's not, my opinion doesn't matter, and starts to shut down. This doesn't take long before you've got a great gulf fixed between them. And so some very simple things can lead to better communication. All right, yes, don't forget the spirit-flesh conflict. In all discussions, in all disagreements, there is still the old man and the new man issues. Not everything you desire is honoring God. It's nice to remind yourself that you too can have distorted vision. You too can be selfish, self-indulgent, self-centered, hopefully not too often. All right, that slide talks about the listening being hard work, which hopefully we've mentioned. And now I want to spend the last few minutes before we take some questions on the physical piece. We do a whole semester on this, so 5 to 10 minutes is not going to get it done. That's not the goal. But I do want to give you a few highlights of the things that I see a lot. The anatomy issues, the differences between men and women, and the help that the physician can be sometimes if there are pain issues. Put this in the back of your mind. Physical intimacy should not be painful. It can be the first week or two as husbands and wives are adapting. You would be wise to warn them. I even warn them about honeymoon cystitis, a very common occurrence. If the couples have waited to marry before intercourse, which is what we desire, then she has at least a 50% chance or maybe greater of having a bladder infection. Well, we can give her the medicine. We docs can give her the medicine before they go on the honeymoon because it's hard to get it. I got a call from Hawaii, a honeymoon couple who didn't take the prescription because they didn't think they'd need it. And that makes for a miserable time together until you treat it. So pain issues need to be looked into. Virtually all of them are treatable, virtually. There's a few tough ones out there, I can tell you, as one who's treated a lot of that. But just basic understanding of how things work can be very helpful. Physiology, function, I do want to talk about that a little bit. Let's see which slide I gave you. With physical intimacy between husband and wife, there are 10 senses involved. This is a fun one to talk about, even if you're not real comfortable talking about sexuality, because there are his 5 and her 5, and if there's a glitch in any of those senses, the physical intimate act is going to be lessened. It may not be totally wrecked, but for men, the number one sensual sense is sight, ordinarily. Not always, but ordinarily. Women understand that, women get that, and what I think we need to do is free the spouses to be as visually alluring to their spouse as they wish. What goes on between them in their agreement, I think there's lots of room for freedom. Sound is a huge deal. Some like rock and roll and rap, others classic music, others like silence. My favorite conference was when a woman said, my favorite sound in the midst of romance is the sound of my husband's voice. Isn't that nice? It was nice. I've remembered it for years because no one else has ever said that. Smell? And surveys of what women don't like about sex. Smell. His smell. 6% of the time. What's the solution to this, gentlemen? A shower. Right. This is not rocket science. But you might also want to tell that to the guys because what happens when men exercise, they not only sweat, but the testosterone hormone elevates. So they get sweaty, but they also get romantic thinking. So they come in, and God has designed our noses in a beautiful way that you become desensitized. You don't know that you stink, but everyone around you does. So, it's fair enough to say, listen, I know you love them, just tell them a shower would be a good idea, or push them in there, or drag them in there, whatever it takes, not a big problem. Taste, you've seen the movies, couples wake up in the morning, and all of a sudden it's romance. This is not happening. Why is it not happening? Right, because the GI tract shuts down when you go to sleep. What's in your mouth when you go to sleep is still there when you wake up. Not a pretty sight. So get you some mouthwash, toothbrush. You see, these are simple, fun things you can broach the subject so they feel like they can talk to you about sexual issues should they come up. And I hope they can. Now, for women, touch is generally the first sense of sensuality. And when I say that, men want to know, what do I touch, where do I touch, how do I touch? And men are simple in their thinking. The reality is, if your relationship stinks, it doesn't matter where you touch. Nothing's going to happen. But every woman is uniquely designed. And I can tell you general areas where the nerves are concentrated, but how you then work that, that's part of what marriage is about, is figuring out that mysterious gift that God has given you and how that works. And to not, there's a book that when I'm not on seminary campus, I generally show. It's entitled, How to Satisfy Your Woman Every Time and Have Her Beg for More. Is that a great title or what? Written by a woman. What's wrong with this book? It makes the assumption that all women are the same. And that is a terrible assumption. If you're going to marry this woman who wrote the book, you need that book. If you've married someone else, you need her to write her own book, because that one is worthless. All right? Now, I wanted to put this on there because I've taught from this. This is a Masters and Johnson, Kinsey, Freud. I mean, this is all the secularist sex studies, and I've had to talk around it for years. Finally, there's a new model. Now, the male model is correct. Men tend to be linear, from excitation to orgasm, 3 to 5 minutes average, but men can learn to control that. So if the woman is pleasured by vaginal penetration, it can last 10. Did you imagine saying that on Southern campus? It's just sort of fun. I do that in class, but you know, this is on tape now, so I'm accountable to all this. But this linear process is fairly quick and leads to a huge endorphin release. Endorphin being the morphine-like chemical that God has placed in the brain that makes the sexual experience blissful. God designed it. It's supposed to be a joy in the proper context. Now, this is the way they charted the woman's sexual response, 15 to 20 minutes on average from excitation to orgasm. And you don't even have to be a math scholar to see that that's going to probably cause some issues. Because in the old sex books, before the one I wrote, because this made me so mad, they said that ideal Christian sex is vaginal penetration to simultaneous orgasm. Don't teach anybody that. It's stupid. That's not the way God designed it. If you understood the anatomy, 2/3 of women will never orgasm by vaginal penetration alone. Never. Only 1/3 do. 2/3 need other kinds of stimulation because God designed it that way. And the idea of simultaneous orgasm, that's a 3% phenomena. God designed it for both, for him to pleasure her, for her to pleasure him. Which order doesn't matter. They just work that out. As long as they both feel sexually satisfied, then we're happy. Men think about the sexual act, not romance, but the sexual act. How often? Normal, healthy man in his 20s. Well, in the teens, it's every 17 seconds. In the 20s, it's 3 to 5 times a day. Normal, average, healthy woman in her 20s thinks about the physical act of sex once or twice per month. That's normal. In a woman's mind and in a man's mind. Not better, not worse, but how much help can you... I can't tell you the number of couples who he says, she doesn't feel the same way about sex that I do. I can fix that. I can give her enough testosterone so she will feel exactly the same way he does. And she will look like me. So if you don't mind the beard, then we can go for it. But that's not the way God designed it, all right? And feel free, the stuff I put in my book, I think humor is important to sort of get people. God designed sexuality, and we're the place to talk about it. If we don't talk about it in the church, it won't get talked about in the home, and they're going to get it from TV and school. You don't want that. I've seen what. How many of you learned about sex from junior high buddies? Yeah, how much of that proved to be accurate? I rest my case, yeah. So the point of this is female satisfaction is a different category from male satisfaction. And you don't try to make one force one into the other. If my desire as a husband should be to please and satisfy my wife, but she gets to decide when she's satisfied. It shouldn't have to fit some model that I saw or heard about that because I saw this movie, it's supposed to look like that. That's just erroneous thinking. So once again, if we get this idea that these are marvelous creations, men and women, and we shouldn't try to make one look just like the other. All right. The hormone story, let me just put the graph up there. Men are simple. When you look at a man, you know that his testosterone is high or higher. Not a lot of options. Testosterone makes your beard grow, deepens your voice, thickens your muscles, and enhances your sex drive. All right? Estrogen is the dominant hormone in women, but it's not the same 2 days in a row. It changes every day. Gentlemen, when you look at your wife every day when you wake up in the morning, she is a new woman. And you would be wise to figure out what kind of day it's going to be, what's going on hormone-wise. But the estrogen causes the lesser voice, the lower, the higher voice, the less hair growth, the less dense muscles, and it also elevates the sex drive, but very gently. The illustration I like is estrogen, warm, gentle breeze. Testosterone, class 5 hurricane. See, a man will go through the wall to get to his woman. The woman will walk out the door, walk around the hallway, and come in the other door. All right? We're just different in that way. But all this changes through life cycles. If Peter says that husbands are to live with their wives in an understanding way or according to knowledge, that means getting the fact that there's a lot of changes going on. And if she happens to use oral contraceptives, if she gets pregnant, this totally changes. Nursing totally changes. Perimenopausal changes again. Menopause changes again. So, gentlemen, if you are called to love well, that means being a lifetime student of your spouse. And I never neglect to tell that premarital couple, what you see now is God's gift to you at this season of life, but you are marrying for the long term. And that means lots of changes. And men change too, obviously. But it's not as quick a change as these monthly changes. We change over time. And these kind of things are very fragile. And for some women, very difficult. Can cause a lot of pain and hormonal swings. And since it's Valentine's Day, and then I'll take questions, just let me use the female graph here with the estrogen peak there, roughly day 14 with a 28-day lady. If you take home today a dozen roses, and she's at that stage of her cycle, how are you going to look? You are going to look fine. But if you bring those same dozen roses and she's at this stage of her cycle, how are you going to look? Guilty. What have you been doing that you're bringing me roses, all right? So this all has to do with living in an understanding way. And it's such a delight, but some of my brothers are so blind to the reality of how remarkably complex God designed women. We are simple, they are complex. We are coffee mug, they are fine china. All right? Any questions for me? I know that's a rapid go, but yes, sir. If you'd wander to the mic, because unless it's a really hard question, then let's not tape it.
It shouldn't be. You addressed previously conflict, where couples have these all-nighters. I've heard people use the verse that says, do not let the sun go down in your wrath,
right,
as motivation for doing this. How would you address that?
I would say that because you're in a covenant relationship and you will still be married the next morning, and your knowledge that this discussion is not going to get any better, you see, you don't have to be angry. You can just say, we are still in disagreement on this. And so I will commit to talk to you about this tomorrow at 10 in the morning or tomorrow at 5 after work. And if you both agree, then you have not violated that scripture, because you have dealt with it and you have committed to deal with it, and you will both rest better, and you will discuss it better, rested, than you ever will at 2 or 3 in the morning. Trust me, as an obstetrician, I've been up lots of 2s and 3s in the morning. There's not a lot of good stuff going on in your brain. You're just trying to focus on one thing at a time. Yes, sir.
You mentioned 4 to 6 premarital counseling sessions. What are the necessary inevitables that you want to include there?
Okay, fair question. The first couple of weeks, I talk about the spiritual intimacy, and I will use once I know who they are a little bit, I'll use some of these books. The one I wrote, Sexual Intimacy in Marriage, my title was Developing Intimacy in Marriage, but the publisher wanted sex to be the first term, so that's how it got there. It's got pretty much a lot of what you've just heard. And if the couples will read that, it will save you a lot of time, because it'll answer a lot of those things. But the spiritual intimacy stuff I talk about first, usually at least 2 weeks on that. Then the relational stuff a couple of weeks, and the physical generally one. Another book I recommend particularly for women to read is called Intimate Issues by Dillo and Pintus, two women authors. And I would not write this book because I don't have the worldview that they do, and it's really nicely done. Women think like women. Men think like men. This is not a bad thing. But we need to appreciate that. Aiken's God on Sex, because he's my friend and I always hype his book. A Celebration of Sex, Doug Rosenau, he's another friend with us down at the Institute for Sexual Wholeness. These are things I'd have on my shelf, and you can decide what you like to use with couples. But what I want to see is, do they have a mature spirituality about them? Do they have some level of communication? Because we can work on that through the coming, and at least a basic of the physical intimacy. The best time to talk about that is 6 weeks to 3 months after they're married. Then they will actually listen to you, because they realize it's not all perfect, we got some issues, and they know where to get some help. So the premarital stuff I use to roll out the carpet and make sure I feel biblically this couple, I can in good faith honor God and perform their ceremony, if that's my job. Anything else? Excellent. I thank you. What's up next, John?